from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump delivered his third State of the Union speech last night.
3 years ago, we launched the Great American Comeback. Tonight, I stand before you to share the incredible results.
We'll get analysis and fact-check some of those results and get your reactions to the speech. And then at 9:30, New Yorker contributing writer Anna Wiener will join us to talk about her new memoir, Uncanny Valley, which chronicles her experiences working customer service jobs at various Silicon Valley startups and the sexist workplace culture she encountered. Join us next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. That was the mood in the House chamber last night when President Trump took the podium to deliver his third State of the Union address. And as he awaits an expected acquittal by the Senate in his impeachment trial later today, President Trump used his speech as a reelection pitch, painting the picture of success and a great American comeback in what analysts are calling one of the most politicized State of the Union addresses in modern history. Here with me to discuss last night's event is Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And welcome, Ron.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you with us. As you can tell, my voice is somewhat ravaged, but I'm trying to be a trooper here. And I may lean on you a little more than usual, but I'm always delighted to have you.
I totally understand. I understand.
It's a broadcaster's nightmare, but it happens now and then. Well, actually, what I'd like to begin is we hear that 4 more years and the Republicans were, shall we say, almost ecstatic about the speech last night and nothing but plaudits, whereas Speaker Pelosi ripped it up. Have we seen a divide like this ever?
Not in my experience. When Ronald Reagan was president, there was surely a great deal of frustration on the part of Democrats at some of his speeches. And when he gave his reelection year State of the Union speech in 1984, there was certainly a lot of campaign aspect to it. And there was partisan response because the Democrats were at that time feeling pretty good. They had picked up seats in the last midterm, as the Democrats did in 2018. And they also still had a majority in the House, and they still felt that they had something to say about what went on in the House of Representatives. But Reagan had his Republicans, and Reagan had the Senate, and Reagan gave what could be called a reelection speech. Now, this, though, was on a completely different plane. Ronald Reagan liked to introduce people up in the gallery. He was the first president to do that, to make use of the gallery as a kind of chorus, as it were, as he performed on stage. He was the first person to introduce a hero from the gallery. That was Lenny Skutnik, who had rescued people from the Potomac River when an airplane went down in the Potomac not too long before the first Reagan State of the Union address, the first one he did after a full year as president. So that's where that tradition came from. But, you know, Trump took all of that to a completely different level last night, not only the pep rally, the campaign speech aspect, but also the reality TV aspect, as I'm sure you saw.
It's been compared to reality TV, particularly in light of the fact that there were some very moving moments, I think it's fair to say, and very emotional moments. But at the same time, there was an attempt really to showcase not only what the president had achieved by his lights and by the lights of his administration, but also to bring in a very human factor. And I think in many ways that human factor stood out.
Oh, it was irresistible. You had a little girl from an inner city school who was there with her single mom, and she had been trying to get into some sort of a private school program, and she had not been able to get off the waiting list and couldn't afford to go to a private school. And so there she sat with her mom in the gallery as the president announced that a scholarship had been found for her, and she was now going to get to go to the school of her choice. And of course, she looked thrilled, and her mother looked thrilled and dewy-eyed. And we were just getting warmed up at that point. The president introduced Rush Limbaugh, certainly a familiar figure to many people, who had just announced that he has a stage 4 lung cancer case. And this was, of course, a highly emotional moment for all of Rush Limbaugh's fans, and that would include all the Republicans on the floor of the House chamber that night. And so when he was introduced and he was then informed that the president was going to give him the Presidential Medal of Honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which apparently he had been told before, but he probably was not prepared for the First Lady sitting next to him to pull it out and put it around his neck right there in the gallery, right on the spot, instead of the usual White House ceremony. And that also was obviously an emotional moment for a lot of people, not limited entirely to Rush Limbaugh's fan base. And then perhaps the coup de grace in all this was reuniting a family where a military wife and her two children were present in the gallery, and suddenly, unbeknownst to them, there appeared behind them their husband, who's been deployed overseas, and he suddenly walked in and walked down and was tearfully reunited with his wife and children. All of this was moving, as you say, no question. And yes, this was perhaps the ultimate production by a president who had made his name in the public, not only with his real estate business, but also with his stardom and producer chops as a reality TV star.
And quite a contrast to that initial speech that was written by Steve Bannon when he came into office. We're talking with Ron Elving, who is senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and we'd like to hear from you. What was your reaction to President Trump's State of the Union? You can give us a call right now. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. Again, you can join us toll-free. 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. Let's hear that cut with Rush Limbaugh.
And Rush, in recognition of all that you have done for our nation, the millions of people a day that you speak to and that you inspire, and all of the incredible work that you have done for charity, I am proud to announce tonight that you will be receiving our country's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
And again, as you indicated, Ron, a great deal of support and happiness from the Republican crowd, but well, the Democrats pretty much sat when that happened.
Sure, how many people listening right now have listened to Rush Limbaugh over the years? He has been a hard right commentator. He was announced as an honorary member of the House freshman class when the Republicans first took back control of the House in 1994, the Newt Gingrich revolution. He was also distinguished, if you will, in the early weeks of the Obama presidency, when he, in contradiction to the Republican Party hierarchy at the time, said he personally hoped that Barack Obama, as president of the United States, would fail, that he would be a failed president, that he didn't want the president to succeed. This at a moment when the economy was in free fall, when the credit markets were seized up, when the aftermath of the 2008 crunch on Wall Street was very much being felt, when unemployment was soaring to eventually 10% virtually. That was a rather curious thing to hear someone say, but it soon became the mantra of many others on the right that, yes, they wanted Barack Obama to fail, even in that moment of national crisis. So for those with long memories about Rush Limbaugh, this is obviously, the president was getting the cheers from his side of the room and knew that. And the ambivalence of the people on the other side of the room certainly looked hard-hearted at a moment like that, but they had a reason.
It's also, I think, safe to say that the president had a laundry list of essentially what many we regard as right-wing agenda items. I mean, he spoke about illegal immigrants. That was the language that he used and, in fact, took a shot at California as a sanctuary state. But he also talked about the importance of the Second Amendment and gun rights. He talked about anti-abortion. It was as if he hit all of those conservative points and hit them, for reasons of electioneering, I presume, but also to keep his base and to feed them some kind of red meat. When he talked even about prayer in public schools and mentioned 187 federal judges, all really strong conservative talking points.
Absolutely. And that is something we would expect of any president in his reelection year, that he would tick through what he saw as his accomplishments. And certainly the president did that, certainly touched on all the aspects of the economy that are good and that are somewhat better than they were when he came into office. The thing I think that would be galling to many Democrats, and especially the Obama administration, was forgetting how much progress was made in the economy between the point when Obama took over in 2009, that I referenced a moment ago, and where we were in 2017 when Donald Trump came into office 3 years ago. So the unemployment rate had come down from around 10 to around 5, and since then it's come down a couple more points. But it was cut in half over the Obama administration, and now it's come down a couple more points to historic lows. Let us note, historic lows in terms of the unemployment rate and historic highs in terms of the number of people who have jobs. The president took credit for that, not only for the portion of it that has taken place while he was president, but for all the improvement since the low point of 2008-2009. And that's galling, obviously, to some Democrats. He also went after the Democrats on, for example, the question of health care. He suggested that he was the person responsible for preserving insurance coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. He said that quite plainly.
Which is absolutely false.
It is absolutely false. He has never done anything to protect pre-existing conditions. And in fact, the administration is in court this very day trying to overturn everything in the Affordable Care Act. And that would include the protection for people with pre-existing conditions. So that's galling. And then you had him saying there are 130 people in this room, of course, meaning House Democrats, who voted for a bill that would take away your health insurance, that would take away this, it would take away that. Very highly finger-pointing kind of partisan stuff that is highly unusual in the State of the Union.
A couple of comments to read here. A listener writes, brilliant speech. It's amazing that he has achieved so much despite such negative media coverage and Democrats' opposition. And Bill writes, whether it's four more years, lock her up, or drill, baby, drill, the GOP slogans reduce serious issues to football chants. To me, it sounds like the Nuremberg rally of the 1930s. And we'll go to your calls. And again, we welcome your calls. You can join us at 866-733-6786. And we begin with Justin. Justin, join us.
Yes, hi, good morning. Hey, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate you just recently breaking down, my voice is bad too, but breaking down, you know, what was real or what is true in his speech, because when I first heard it, I'm not a Republican. I really dislike, Trump representing us, representing the American people. But man, when I listened to that speech, I thought it was great. I was floored. I was blown away. I was like, wow, if all of this is true, then, hey, we're I guess he's doing things, and it's sounding really good. And I don't know, maybe this State of the Union address is something that can help a lot of people kind of even out some tensions between political parties. And I don't know. I just felt that it was really well executed. One thing I didn't like is was mentioned before, how he commented a lot about the previous administration not doing this and not doing that, and I was able to get it done. I don't necessarily like bashing on, what came before us, but I thought it was overall, I was wow. If all of this is true, what he said was true, then hey, it went over really well.
I thank you for that call. And Ron, Justin's remarks actually pinpoint what may have been the success of that speech. The president was appealing to America first, to a comeback, but also to patriotism, to nationalism. It was pretty much unbridled and to use a word, naked. And that appeals to people who certainly feel strong about the United States and may even be his adversaries.
Yes, I appreciate Justin's remarks very much. I appreciate his candor. I think a lot of people who have problems with this president or with any president have tuned in over the years for the State of the Union and heard this kind of presentation and thought, I feel better now. I feel better because the president really seems to be in control, or the president really seems to be accomplishing a lot. And gee, if all that's true, things are pretty good. And of course, that is rather a pretty good size if, in some cases, for example, the president tends to embroider a little bit and tends to leave out the full story. He says the stock market is up 70% since I've been president. He doesn't really give the figure that most economists would give, which is closer to 56-57%. But hey, that's pretty good, right? Most people would be happy with that. But the president bumps it up to 70%. And he doesn't mention that the vast majority of that stock market improvement has gone to the people with the top 10% of incomes, and that the bottom 45% of income people in the United States have no share in the stock market at all. But you wouldn't expect that. This is a speech that is supposed to accentuate the positive. Maybe it's supposed to mention problems, but it's supposed to accentuate the positive and talk about the State of the Union as being strong, because after all, that's what the president's job is, to make the State of the Union strong.
And here is another caller. Guillermo joins us. Good morning. Guillermo.
Morning, and thank you for taking. Yes, hi. Good morning, and thank you for taking my phone call. I just want to point it out to the speech, the juxtaposition that he did 4 years ago or 3 years ago when he called all Central America countries and the Caribbean a word that I don't can say in the radio. But last night he was lift out all those nations because he says, "Oh well, we did a deal with El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico, and." About 3 years ago, he was putting down everyone for...
Oops. Something went wrong with that line, but he was crowing a bit about trade deals. And let's talk about that, Ron, because there are many who feel that, well, he got rid of NAFTA. Did he get something that's that much better than NAFTA? He mentioned China. These were cornerstones in that speech of real accomplishments as he presented them.
And, of course, he ran against NAFTA as a candidate, and he immediately said we were going to be getting out of it, then renegotiated a deal, which is, in many respects, NAFTA 2.0, except that it does have a number of requirements on some of our trading partners that were insisted upon by the Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, who had been sitting behind him. And did the Democrats get any credit for that in the speech, for having worked with him on USMCA, which is the successor agreement, the NAFTA 2.0? They did not. So that is galling to them as well. And the president takes full credit for things when the Congress cooperates with him and condemns Congress for its non-cooperation when things don't get done. So that, too, is what you expect, generally speaking, in a president. But with the sort of flamboyant theatricality with which the president gave this speech, and pretty much every rally speech we ever see him give, and we can expect him to be in this mode throughout his reelection year, This is galling to all those who have had the dilemma of, do we help, do we cooperate, or do we not?
That theatrical mode, I think, was particularly evident when he was talking about killing al-Baghdadi and killing the Iranian commando leader. Let's hear a cut about actually terrorism and his remarks about terrorism, and what almost sounded like an invitation to Iran.
Our message to the terrorists is clear. You will never escape American justice. If you attack our citizens, you forfeit your life. Because of our powerful sanctions, the Iranian economy is doing very, very poorly. We can help them make a very good and short time recovery. It can all go very quickly, but perhaps they are too proud or too foolish to ask for that help. We are here. Let's see which road they choose. It is totally up to them.
Is that a kind of olive branch, do you think, Ron? How do you read that?
Some people have read it as an olive branch, and some people have seen it that way. This is similar to what we offered North Korea. If you will simply get rid of your nuclear weapons, this is the message to North Korea now, we will help you build luxury hotels on some of that beautiful shoreline in North Korea, and you could be a very successful country. You simply have to change directions entirely and get rid of your nuclear weapons, which are the reason we're talking to you in the first place. In the Iranian case, we say you must abandon all aspirations toward nuclear weapons, which is something that would certainly be a relief to most of the people in that region, certainly to our ally Israel, if Iran were to abandon those ambitions. And you must also, of course, follow along with a number of other things we would like to see you do and stop threatening Israel and so on. That would be of something that would please many Americans if Iran would back off of in having a nuclear weapon, if Iran would back off of its confrontational actions towards Israel and to its confrontational actions to regimes all over the Middle East. They've been a very highly active disruptor in other countries. So the president is speaking for most Americans with what he says to Iran. But people were disturbed at the way that we just went in with a drone and killed their supreme or their one of their highest military commanders, one of their most important military commander, in an extrajudicial way that was not even messaged to Congress, let alone subject to their approval. And that seemed reckless to an awful lot of Americans, at least according to the polls. But because Iran has not mounted any kind of retaliation, or at least not particularly strong retaliation, did some damage and hurt some American soldiers, but no deaths thus far, many Americans are seeing that, too, as a Trump success and saying this is a better posture in dealing with Iran than we had before. Our allies don't think so. A lot of people in our military are uneasy about it. But at the moment, at least, the optics are pretty good for the president.
Since you mentioned polls, the numbers are pretty good for the president, too. He's Gallup poll, 49% approval.
That is the highest he has ever been in the Gallup, and he has certainly noticed that. He's been as low as the mid to high 30s in the Gallup, and so impeachment has helped him there. I don't think there's any question about it. But his main buoy in the Gallup and in other polls is the success of the economy. At this time, unemployment being so low, the stock market being so high, wages beginning to recover some of the ground that they've lost in recent decades in relative terms. All of those things should help any president. In fact, one thing that Trump's critics have asked is, why, with this economy, is he not at 60% approval? Why is he not at 65% approval? Bill Clinton had episodes of being over 70% approval. And part of the reason for that, they say, is perhaps just plain partisanship. And part of it is perhaps a sense on the part of a lot of people, including in the Republican Party, that some of the things the president does just are not presidential. They're inappropriate. They're even wrong. They're even disgraceful. And I'm quoting here from Republican senators in some of their speeches explaining how they're going to vote on impeachment. And in the end, having said those things about him, they say, but we don't think he should be removed from office. And that ambivalence, I think, you see in a Gallup poll of almost 50-50.
Read a comment from a listener named Mike, who says President Trump turned the State of the Union into an embarrassing spectacle, exploiting the grief, stress, and sacrifice of military families. As a Gold Star family member, I was aghast. And Martha writes, I'm a Democrat, but I think Nancy Pelosi tearing up Trump's speech in front of everyone was tacky. And Jean writes, Nancy Pelosi made a mistake to allow Trump to give a State of the Union address on primetime TV. She could have chosen to ask him to provide Congress with a written update instead. That's all the Constitution requires. It's actually an interesting point. You want to comment, Ron?
Yes, the presentation of the State of the Union for most of our history was just a written report. But along came Woodrow Wilson, and he was a political science professor, and he liked to lecture people, and he wanted to lecture Congress. Congress had been his specialty as a political scientist. So back a century ago, he said, I'm going to come to Congress and give it to you directly. Now, there was a precedent. George Washington had done that in the very early days when they all were present there together. And that seemed to be an adequate precedent to Woodrow Wilson. But since Woodrow Wilson, we've been seeing it as a direct message in almost every year to the Congress, delivered in person. And since the television age, we've also been seeing it on TV. And that has come to be something that the country expects.
Ron, always good to have you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good to be with you, Michael. Feel better.
Thank you for that. Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. When we return, we're going to talk to Anna Weiner, contributing writer for The New Yorker, has a book. It's a memoir of her work in Silicon Valley. Stay tuned.